Blog Talk Radio.
April 2015. It's the 109th day of the year. Hard to believe we've made it this far. Hard to believe that things keep going on the way they always have, no matter what we seem to think. You know, I find myself vacillating today, and I need your help. You know, when you get in those moods where you're just wandering, your thoughts are wandering a bit. We have this interesting and curious experience here. It's great to be alive. It's better than the alternatives. We struggle to find the essentials, don't we? And to enjoy ourselves. What's the point of all of this? Some sense of handling the practicalities of life depends, I guess, on your orientation and your background and your experience. Is life to be a stern, austere experience? Is it to be enjoyed? Well, we know that in anything taken to excess seems to become problematic. Now, in the eyes of whom? And so we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about how important it is to keep things in perspective and how to go about doing that. And the whys. Why is it useful? It's like, every single moment of every single day, I know that there are people with I almost think that they're compelled to show their devotions by everything that they do. If you ask me candidly, does this make a person a better person? In that person's eyes, they are. If you ask another person who is going about his or her business without causing complications for as much as they can, you know, there's circumstances that we can't control. People with a sense of joie de vivre and a sense of purpose and camaraderie. Also, the person that just wants to, the real challenging person, the person that needs their privacy for whatever reason and does not want to engage. Now, if you can, we meet these people all the time that respect that. It's not like it's something bad. It's just that person needs privacy, and they grant it, particularly to their friends and family. They know enough not to intrude constantly because they can. Well, that's a little bit of what we call it, a bit of maturity. But we have those from the eyes of the perspective of that group of people. Somebody that's dedicating everything, has a lifestyle that's quite a bit different, can seem, unhappy. So why are the state of mind of one person it doesn't have that mathematical precision that if over in a far and distant land somebody says this is the way of life so that one can achieve happiness, why isn't that same package of ideas and ways of means of existing and talking and communicating and their practices universal? Why is that? it seems that we can achieve the same kinds of outcomes from many different paths. The journey that we often blithely hear offered to our new initiates, you enjoy your Masonic journey. Well, I think it's a little more accurate to say it's a sojourn. You know, it comes and goes, doesn't it? Little bits. You're off on a little journey, and then you're off on another little journey. You know, it's like, how in the world do you possibly... I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it is what it is, that we have this sense of mystery, that how do we do this? Why is there that lack of uniformity? Why is it always a little bit of a challenge? And why do we often come up with the notion that if it's not my way, that if it's not consistent with my culture or your culture, then it's something wrong? You know, that's a bad thing. Why is that? We have to keep that in mind somehow. I think that's vital. That there's more going on around us, and we get, what do we do with the people that aren't I don't know if we call it worldly or insightful, that can grasp that the fact that people come at you know, there's many roads to Rome, as the saying goes, and the appetite for harmonics, the need for peace, the respect for it, or is it simply the fatigue of war that drives us to accept our brother on some other plane? That whatever they're doing, as long as it meets some of the common connections between cultures, is perfectly fine. And Masonry struggles within its own skin to exercise that element of universality. It's so remarkable that we can look around our lodges at the proportion, a disproportionate level of homogeneous cultures, skin colors and cultural backgrounds and histories and gene pools, and think of ourselves as universal. And that seems like we like the idea of it, but we just aren't quite, we're a little bit timid about the execution. You know, just a little bit timid. So nobody explained to us, well, we enjoy the idea of having an open attitude toward the world around us. Nobody told us that would be easy. And certainly nobody told us that it wouldn't be without its price. Nobody guaranteed that. Nobody ever said that the understandings of... And I would say that Masonry engages us to become and challenges us to be much more what's called a liberal. I don't know if that's it has a lot of connotations these days, but it challenges us. The liberal mind seems prepared to look for the alternative explanations. So instead of the black and white world being around us, our black and white world is mathematics. The uniformity and the dispassionate accuracy of math, the purity, that's where we look for accuracy. That is something that all people can trust. And still, we have great difficulty, don't we? How many times do we look, we hear the struggles against science? Science is something that can be proven. There is evidence to support the conclusions and outcomes and the work. Now, we know that there are many, many people who just refuse, for whatever reason, and usually and often very emotional about it, refuse to accept. And now this is, except science. Now, this isn't new. If you think back over the course of our history, this has been with us for how many, we've been aware of this for how long? I think we've pretty much concluded, at least I want to say here in Canada, that we're not trapped in the ethnocentrism of the past, that we know what's the big joke, you know, a Columbus discovery is now sort of used tongue-in-cheek. Didn't really discover anybody. Go back home and say, oh, look what I discovered. I discovered Las Vegas. Well, your outlook needs to be able to have what we call humor. This is the devil in the details, when we're able to laugh at ourselves. Again, I'm thinking that the deeper questions, the essential questions are often like this, that they're often like, why are some able to laugh at themselves and others see nothing but dread? Why are some people paralyzed by the notion of their own mortality and others look forward to it as a natural occurrence? It's one of those fascinating little things, isn't it? So here we go. We plunge into being impolite company for each other for the next hour, asking questions that touch on parts of the brain and their experience that are never to be touched in pleasant company. So prepare. You prepare yourself. We're Masons, and I wondered why we're so darn timid. Why are we so darn timid? Why is compliance, feel so safe, tucked in with the status quo? And then out of the other side, the other hemisphere of your brain, you know that everything around us, including us, you and me, is in a constant state of flux. So what status quo are we trying to achieve? So if you think about these things, you ask the questions, all of a sudden it's like asking the question doesn't necessarily mean we have the answer. It means we're a work in progress. We've got it under advisement. We're thinking about that one. So you tell me. This is the most learned and scary audience I've ever had today. What is the value in preserving and protecting status quo? Where and what does that do, or what has it done to our sense of collective confidence? Because we're impolite. I think I'll answer part of that myself. We see some of the people, or some of our brethren, that are just a bit off the bubble, off level. And they're saying and doing things that don't make sense. In the past, we've had some embarrassing challenges to our leadership. People at rank and file have a right to do that. But they've done it in a very coarse, impolite, ungentlemanly fashion. And I think every so often, I think that's a very useful sacrifice that they're making. I think that's the kind of event we need to be able to talk about, that when one of us shames himself, we begin to experience how everybody else around reacts to that. Oh, his name will be, does he care how he's known? Well, his name will carry that baggage for a long, long time, won't he? But that said, we'll get into the high and mighty ethicists who will walk around saying, well, we'll just forget him or forgive him, or, you know, we'll try and explain and understand what the person was trying to do. We can do that. We're quite capable of doing it. But after a while, doesn't that feel a bit tedious to you? And what does it do when we close down dissent? It makes us more precarious. It makes us, I think, less philosophically based, firmly based, well thought through, insightful than we presume. So if somebody has a dissenting opinion, bring up the facts. Bring up the facts. Tell us the reasoning. If it's just a personality that is prone to taking advantage and really not too concerned about the effect of what he says on others around him, we don't have any room for somebody insulting us? Well, we can't stop it. We can't stop somebody going rogue. We can't. But the sanction, the reaction, seems to be very, very clear. It's if somebody's distasteful, they're become more and more isolated in their own mind. And unfortunately, as much as we may want to be tolerant and reach out, there will always be those defining personalities that show that our principles and our order has the limits, natural, reasonable limits. I've created a composite, one of us. Today, you know that we're doing an interview with Masonic Ed. Well, Masonic Ed is a bit of a genius, don't you know? Just about everything he touches is wonderful. And when he can't come up with answers, you know, it's remarkable to see how he handles it. But I said today that I was Masonic Ed was gracious enough to join us in the studio to talk about things Masonic, but he prefers to maintain his anonymity. So he feels that if his voice were heard or his face seen, that people would instantly recognize him. And oh my goodness, we apart from another expose by Edward Snowden. Oh, isn't that an interesting little nerve we just touched there? I could feel the electricity coming through the airwaves here. So we'll plunge on and protect privacy. And again, I want you to tell me the difference between privacy and secrecy. I'm going to come back and ask that question. There will be a skill testing test at the end of this. Who could resist speaking about privacy and secrecy with Ed? If our productions of antiquarians is meeting the need, who could resist? Ed is an attentive fellow, so of course he notices the culture of Canada is more cosmopolitan than it was when he was a boy. At times when he is feeling tired, he feels on one hand he is being displaced, and on the other hand proud that Canada is coming of age. It was obvious to us to speak about strengthening our membership by drawing on first and second generation Canadians from the pool who are here quietly appreciative of the opportunities this huge, friendly country has to offer. He worries out loud that the order will need to tackle the legitimacy of dissenting opinions. That brings us to talk about accountability versus blame. I question Ed on whether he thinks the craft in Ontario has become defensive or reactionary. His answers may surprise you. But what he said about the cultural transition of ideas and ethics plaguing Masonry may not be what you expect. He talked with me about how and whether we were keeping up. The order was impacted by the change, the evolution, the progress of our Canadian culture. I was thinking, as he was talking to me, I was thinking of this like two icebergs, rubbing against each other out in the great big ocean. Well, much of what goes on, you know, the iceberg is just this little piece at the top with this great huge mass under the water level. What we see is just like a bookmark that we know that the bulk of the mass is unseen. So if you have two of these rubbing against each other, the points aren't going to touch because the mass underneath the water is already scraping away at the other. So he was talking, he talked with me at length about, that's the impression that I, how I formed the picture in my mind about what we were talking about. And I think he raised a few good points. He was saying that the ideas, that culture changes ideas. And I thought that it's really an irrefutable point of view, because even language changes over the decades. We inject new words into the vocabulary and have done, we can trace this back centuries. And the meaning of words changes according to the meaning of the common experience of the culture. So remember, there was a time in our history, well, I guess, what do we call, maybe 14th century, 13th century, where spelling was not too concerning. The meaning of words, we didn't have definitions. And you think about when the dictionaries, Oxford, Johnson, you think about the development of dictionaries, it had to be done so that it was done. And that was an effort to standardize and to create common, improve understanding of the written word. Well, the print word, and made that more accessible. So if we're on the same wavelength here, what Ed is getting at is that as those, we went from a time, out of time, it's not remembered, eh? We went from a time when the meaning of the word was expected to come from the context of its usage. That was around a time in certain areas of the world when, as you were reading, you couldn't really tell what language you were into. You really couldn't. And spelling was very, very fluid. This was a time when ownership of ideas was different than it is today. That today we often we'll talk about, we don't often, but in general, but we know about plagiarism. We want to credit the idea. And yet, if you run a few of our antiquarians through the room, they may say that the person claiming to have ownership of an idea is in fact extrapolating from earlier conversation. The more you know about the history, the more you are a student of our history, the more you can trace the comments and ideas to the roots buried deep in our Middle Earth. So here we have the question for us as Masons: how do we understand the effect of the changes that have gone on around us? If you ask, as Ed did, does this mean that we're staying ahead of the curve and anticipating this process? Well, that really made me exercise my manners. It was like I was confused by it, and I didn't have on one hand, the answer that immediately came to mind was no, we don't really don't. But that seemed to cast a shadow on the order, and I didn't want to do that. I think we are today, and in this conversation, I began to think that instead of two icebergs rubbing against each other, what Sonic Ed was doing with me was holding up the order as if it was this beautiful orb, and that we could turn it around in our hands so that we could examine it from different perspectives. So I thought, well, that's kind of curious, because from one hand I could say, one perspective I could say, no, we're not staying ahead of the curve, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think the general measure is of all of these discussion points is something that is very porous when we think about the progress. And we love ideas like excellence and refinement and dedication. We like the ideas. Execution of that, nobody likes to do all of that work. The actual work is in the mind. I think the order of masonry, again, there is that perspective. Now, is that the dominant? I don't think there necessarily is a dominant perspective, but I think the order, that orb, all of a sudden can be balanced on the point of your fingertip or on the head of a pin, the point of a pin. Because then, if we're able to look at the world through the eyes of somebody else who doesn't agree with us, if we're able to understand the thinking of the enemy, then we have less reason to be fearful. We have more reason to make decisions and think strategically to influence outcomes. You may be thinking that this is something that's self-evident, that the struggle for those balance points is just that. It's not a certain, it's not a geometric or a mathematical guarantee. It's a property of mathematics. So we can find the balance point. But when we look at this orb, do we know where the balance point is? Well, it doesn't just leap out at us. And as we turn it around, we know the very simple parts. If you are, and I think that Ed agreed that this had some legitimacy. If we're coming into the order, and the men of good conscience are saying, you come, you're a friendly fellow, and you attend. You don't study, you don't add to the conversation, you're not thoughtful, but you attend. Okay. That's enough. Well, I think that subscribes to an idea that minimizes the training, the profile of Freemasonry, that it's just enough kind of an organization. Well, it offers that. It offers friendship and camaraderie, social connection. It offers that. It certainly does. But I think that maybe getting back to the icebergs, that's a chunk of something buried deeper. That's not exactly the product. It's not exactly what it's selling. The idea is that is a vehicle. The polite conversation and sharing common meal is a vehicle for discussion. Always a vehicle for discussion based on a capacity to develop trust. When people are trusting, it's when and they're confident, we're able to draw the conversation into something that's quite frank and quite enriched. When we expect people to do more than we expect everybody to have an opinion, but you'll find, you know, we have to teach our little boys that there's opinions that are trite, there are opinions that are impolite, there are opinions that are valid. There are ways of saying, dealing with sensitive topics that protect the sensibilities of the listener and don't ruin one's reputation in the meantime. But it's a matter of awareness, a matter of learning the social graces so that we know how to go about dealing with indecorous conversation. Now, this makes sense to Ed. Not in terms of what to do, but in terms of understanding. He began to laugh at me, though. I was thinking that we were making headway in the conversation. And there he goes laughing at me, saying, is this all that you're, is this like a preoccupation among your lot? And then he explained that this preoccupation he had noticed was talking like this, talking about each other as if it was gossip, talking about our, not doing a whole lot to drill into history, not doing a whole lot to have a conversation about philosophy of living, about personal development, you know, the ideas that he says are the predominant ideas of Freemasonry. Always. That if you're going to be around, you want to improve your lot in life, of course you want to be in the company of people that are gentlemen. That makes sense. And is it a truism? Yeah, it is. Somebody might be very smart and be quite a cad or quite a scoundrel. What we see, though, Masonry equips us enormously to live inside the community of the Masonic statutes and rules. And everything about the outside world is reflected and mirrored inside our lodges. So here we can examine up close our reaction to some very odd things going on. And by other people. And we can examine very carefully then in this environment what our reaction to all of these shenanigans says about us. Is it important that somebody's a bit of a knucklehead? In the great scheme of things, you've got nothing, you don't have anything better to think about? Is it important for that we respect that doing things based on principles may not be evident to everybody else around? Well, yeah, that's important. If we are only doing things for appearance, it makes us appear a bit shallow, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. As it should. Because if we're doing something for principle, people might not know about that unless they're looking for it. And that, unless they're asking the questions, what's behind this person? What motivates them? What drives them? What satisfies them? Do they show the important things? Not whether we're in complete synchronized step with one another, but whether they're serious and dedicated, going about their business. And as you heard, you remember that charge, going about his business, living within his bounds, living within his limits, and being generous. You know, those are things that don't necessarily depend on whether you or I pass judgment and agree with it. It happens regardless. And I think that gets into the freedom of the Masonic personality. Our culture is changing around us. And we will learn more about ourselves as we learn more about these other the other cultures. Not that they're a threat to what we have here in Canada. We have something really well preserved and clearly respected. Other people have come here. The fact of the matter is, we haven't gone there. Other people come here for their own reasons, but generally it has to do with opportunity. And it wouldn't matter where a knucklehead lands on the planet. He's going to say and do things that don't make any sense. Out there, do we find that we have to have that some people go overboard? Well, that's why we have to have police. And we know that and we're learning those lessons painfully all around us lately, that when we have to give a lot of power to an authority to our people that protect us, but we also need to keep a very, very tight rein on them, because as anything, anybody with a little bit of power, with power, will tend to become overbearing. They'll tend to become self-serving and being able to justify actions within their own core belief. That becomes the foundation for many of our laws, and this is a nation of law. So, is the culture of Freemasonry, how is it contributing and how is it reacting to the larger changes going on around us? How much of the reaction do we control, and how much of it is that matter of natural acceptance? Is Freemasonry mortal or immortal? Well, we break that down, the little bits and units of Freemasonry make it mortal. So does that mean that, what does that mean to you? Well, I'm thinking that people come, people enjoy, people go, people die, but the idea remains, the ideas remain valuable generation after generation after generation. And as Ed pointed out then, he was making an assumption for me. And then, what are you really saying? That it doesn't matter the membership trajectory, whether it's increasing or decreasing, doesn't matter? I said, well, it does, but not in the sense of whether the Masonry is going to survive. Masonry, it's Masonry as we know it. In other words, the status quo that will likely be changing. And that means that we may not like that. We may be quite alarmed, but we can't do anything about it. We need to examine and understand what it is that's going on so that we don't look at ourselves through as superstitious little creatures. You know, that vibration under the earth that we thought was the Creator punishing us for not being devout enough? Well, we find it's the rubbing of great big Teutonic plague stone. And then people like some of the wizards out there notice that we're fracking and we're draining the aquifers, and there's probably going to be a settling of the earth's crust, and that'll probably be leading to a lot of these little shifts and earthquakes. Again, there will be people that will tend to think this is a punishment for something that has gone on in the vernacular, and so should thrust themselves in a more dedicated and pious way of living. All good. But we can't really allow ourselves to be governed by superstition, because we paid a hell of a price to get out from under that dynasty. Doesn't mean that it's not soothing. It is soothing to the soul. And if you're just not that complex a thinker and you want things nice and safe and predictable, there you have it. Make things, create an understanding that simplifies the world just the way you need. And it's not a bad thing. It's certainly something that that thinkers have been examining over the millennia. Doesn't say that it's not the man that's ponderous and sits in lotus position that is necessarily the person with insight. It could be the fellow with a hoe tending his garden faithfully every day. What's on his mind while he's doing that is the work, his mantra. Is that his meditation? For many of us here in Canada, that's it, and in the world, that's what we've known as the work ethic. And so we need to, though, be knowledgeable about how we've managed to handle these questions over the millennia. They don't go away. So when you get into sitting down in a lodge, we live in a lifestyle, many of us, where we don't have 5 points of devotion during the course of our day. although the early Christian calendar, that was something, and still some orders of the orthodoxy, those points are still maintained, and you can do that as well. So we know that there are many religions that have those different points of devotion during the course of a day. So we're not maybe in our secular world exposed to all of that like we would have been if we were in Greece, where it was almost every single day a day to make a devotion or sacrifice to another god or goddess. And so to be a good Greek, you would keep up with those sacrifices. Oh, yeah, it took money. And it took organization to make that happen. But during the day, Greeks, 3rd, 4th century Greece, you would B.C., you would be making sacrifices to the shrines in your own home before you stepped outside. Here in this world, where we have had to... We've understood that secularism, that notion that there is no one dominance, that everybody is free to select and understand in their own way. The government doesn't intrude in the mind. But to preserve the kind of harmonics, we agree to certain conventions. And that way it seems to reduce that, you know, offense, whether it's intended or not. We try to live, and we call that kind of existence harmony. Other people around the world will probably shudder and think this is a really desperate situation that's going to lead to some very, very bad things if you don't have your faith being the dominant faith. Really? Well, history teaches us that we have had armies go into battle because each of them thinks they're the dominant. And at the end of the day, what happens is that the soldiers just die. You can keep hatred and you can keep the killing going on until you kill all the soldiers. Do the soldiers want to die? No. But the people in command get their mind set that they're anything that is not compliant with their worldview is a threat. Then you know and I know that there's always going to be that mindset out there, that people are always, always going to find that discrepancy, people practicing according to their own way, and that you can try and you can kill the people, but you can't kill the idea. And so Masonry comes along and takes this beautiful basket of ideas and brings it forward and says, look at it. This is quite cool. This has passed the test of time. And this way of thinking about those icebergs out there and this orb that we have held in our hand is a very satisfying way of living. Here I need to talk to you a little bit about ways of living and ways of thinking that are complementary to you. I want to talk to you a little bit about cynics, Epicureans, Stoics, and skeptics, if you don't mind, just a little bit. The Epicureans, I'll talk to you first about cynics. Is that okay? Yeah, it's just because it's one of the things that I think in my own character, I tend to be a little harsh and often concern myself that I'm too cynical. Some people, though, this came out of the Hellenistic societies, so they adhered to this as a philosophy, a school of philosophy, a school of thought that others saw that was hardly worthy of the name of, you know, oof. The founder of cynicism was Antisthenes. got all the teeth still. When he was about 40, he watched Athens defeated in the Peloponnesian War. He was at the time considered a good student. His teacher was Socrates, and he witnessed the execution. Huh, how grim. So he saw the downside of the masses. You know, there was the masses, those 700 jurors or so, that ruled that Socrates should die. No, they ruled that he had misled the youth of Athens. And so Antisthenes was absolutely disgusted, like Plato. He became very, very tired of the quibbling of the lions, the geniuses of philosophy. And he saw him. He did think that he could be influential, that he was a teacher. So, you know, this isn't like somebody that finds the word polyglot and says, well, that's what I want to be when I grow up. What do I have to do? That seems contrived, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. This is more the person that goes about developing different things at different times in their life. And at the end, by observation, without being manipulated by saying, oh, this is what I'm going to do so I'm seen as a polyglot. That's manipulation. These are people that coincidentally have developed expertise in a number of different areas. And we refer to them, not them. We ascribe to them that they are polyglot. So he was a very, very bright guy. But he didn't want to live in a world where virtue was just demanded. I'm dressing up, I have this rank, therefore you should honor me. That's what we're talking about. And especially with the immorality and corruption going on around. And he was one of those people that saw that clearly rank and power did not make a person a greater person. Antisthenes had a student that you've heard about, Diogenes. And he came along well before Alexander the Great, another student of Aristotle, yeah. Diogenes, he didn't like his dad's profession. His father was a money changer. Yeah, you change a currency and you make a little bit of a profit. And he didn't go around chasing, trying to be wealthy. But he found that there was some virtue in having very few possessions or no possessions, in simplicity and in modest wants. Bit of an what we call the aesthetic, yeah? Yeah, kind of interesting. And he rejected fame and honor. But his demonstrations of asceticism were so novel, they're so out there, that the Greeks around started to pay attention to him. And many of them began to think that he was very bright. Yeah, okay, he was taking slings and arrows. You get a bit of stick when you start to talk. And you read a little bit and you start to talk about what you're reading. You always do. But in his old age, his fame was enough that Alexander visited him and asked if there was any favor that he wanted. And Diogenes, as the story goes, said that he only wanted that Alexander stand out of his sunlight. Alexander. Yeah. Get out of my sunlight here. Stand out so you could enjoy the sun. In the times, the Hellenistic times that followed after Alexander died, a few philosophers adopted the thinking and style of Antisthenes and Diogenes. They wandered about, and in town squares, they discussed social conventions and simple virtues. Like-minded men. Maybe that was certainly there was no one link that started the organization of masonry, but, and they weren't masons because they did this. This was something that they did. It was with these cynics that the word cosmopolitan was developed. A word used to signify that they belonged to no state. They advocated salvation from worry and conflict, which you think today, would that help you and me? They were entertaining to listen to, but cynicism forever would remain a small and barely influential movement. For most people, the call to drop out made no sense. They were already barely able to feed and clothe themselves and their families. The cynics were really not interested in economic realities. Well, you think, I live in a place where I have to have some shelter because it's cold. We just came over. Anyway, I'm being selfish here. So only a few could go without working and living off what was provided by others' people's labors. Most had to struggle to get by, and the cynics must have appeared as much the, you know, just didn't make any sense. So that's the cynics. The Epicureans, another philosophy that focused on how to live. But they were similar to the cynics. They believed it was best to purge oneself of the appetite for power or fortune, and they favored withdrawal from the corruptions of society. So they wished to keep the wealth and possessions that helped make life pleasant. And most Epicureans were people who had accumulated some wealth. Well, I don't know if that's having a little bit of money in the bank, paying off the bill collectors. But Epicurus, he came from an Athenian family, and he was on, let's say, an island, Samos, yeah. And he went to Athens when he was 18 to just confirm that he was an Athenian. And that was the year before Alexander died. And he took up residence in the city of Mytilene. And he stayed there. But when he turned 30, he became recognized as a philosopher, Epicurus. He had influences that we know about, particularly materialism. He believed that humanity created its destiny without interference from capricious spirits. Wasn't the discontentment of one of the gods or goddesses that influenced our destiny? And he complained about religion. He said it was unnecessarily frightening people, describing them at the mercy of gods and demons. He said that's not right. And he became, he wasn't, he escaped from the, you know, atheism was very unpopular. And that at the time was speaking about the gods as if they were nature rather than nature's creators. So the gods claimed Epicurus should be worshipped with neither fear nor hope. And do not fear, and his idea was do not fear death, for it's an eternal sleep, and the dead feel no pain or torment. Better to throw our hands in the air and shriek than to accept something as natural as that. Welcoming home, huh? But Epicurus talked about the ultimate question of life by saying that was it. The question is worth life worth living? The ultimate question. Yeah, of course it is. Foregone conclusion, healthy ego. He saw life, it could be joy, you know, he did. If one had an adequate sensitivity to the world of beauty and good friendships and good health, and you were free from drudgery. He believed in the pleasures of contemplation and physical beauty and attachments to others, friendships, connections, volunteering, helping. But he, the Epicurean, believed that the essential force of life was the avoidance of pain. He believed that the essence of virtue in avoiding inflicting pain upon others was virtue. Don't hurt other people. He believed that the avoidance of pain for oneself and for others should be precedent over the pursuits of pleasure. Don't cause damage. He advocated self-control to avoid painful consequences. And he said the pleasure should be adjusted to the equilibrium of one's body and mind. Excessive devotion to the gratification of appetite, he said, produced misery rather than happiness. So if you just eat like a pig, you're going to be unhappy. See, so the importance he's talking to us about is health, achieving that and being aware that if we don't, if we are neglectful, then it's misery. And I like the cynics, Epicurus and his followers believed in community. He thought that it was in the best interest of society that people carry out agreements that promote fellowship, you know, politics. He implied a contractual form of government, yeah. But he didn't advocate group action for social change. That was, you know, not something that he thought it was more important that living unnoticed, abstaining from public life and from making enemies, an approach to politics that suited those living under authoritarian rule who wished to continue living comfortably. So we think about it, how much of authoritarian rule is happening here? Are we perceiving the erosion of our rights? Oh, C-51, we've got that going on here in Canada. It was, you want to know who avowed this kind of philosophy? Get your pens and crayons out, gentlemen. It was Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. Deism, we've talked about this on the show, was very popular in the day. That put God outside the human affairs. You know, God didn't help me get the touchdown. God didn't help me achieve health. It wasn't that God was handing out favors. So that was popular in Jefferson's day, and he described Epicureanism as the most rational philosophical system of the ancients. And this is where we find expression in his contribution to the Epicurean influence in the American Declaration of Independence. Ha! The pursuit of happiness. Where have we heard that term being bandied about? Challenge for yourself whether there's any merit in we'll talk about the other elements of Stoicism, and we'll talk about the Stoics and the Skeptics, you know, we'll get into that, but the pursuit of happiness as an Epicurean expression, yeah, through Jefferson. There you have it. Work that into your conversation, and I'm happy to think that being part of a masonry is an unusual challenge, and it's that if you who defines the success and value of masonry, not the Grand Lodge. You understand the values. You understand the opportunity. You understand the effort and this holy grail that we call perfection. It's never-ending challenges. You understand that. As you conduct yourself, people will define masonry. Organizationally, we don't cut it. Individually is where we have the greatest impact, because masonry never says that, never says that. All of the initiations, not all of the ritual is about making the organization better. Never. It always is aimed at making the individual, making you and I a better person. So I hope you'll come back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for making Masonic Home Companion as successful as it is. We're going to play a little tune today. Not too many tunes right now. We'll play a little tune to... and I'm going to get Billie Holiday to play us out today. This is a song that has veiled meaning. You may have heard it. It's called Strange Fruit. And this is considered one of the first anti-racist songs. She was very brave, eh? Think about it. When you hear this, what she's talking about, the fruit hanging in the trees are the bodies of men who have been lynched, black men. Billie Holiday ended, you know, had her tragedy. She came from a very meager start. Listen to it. Let it linger in your mind and think a bit about what it says, eh? What it does for all of us. See you soon.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather.